This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Growing up without a father can be a painful experience for a boy. Many men who grew up fatherless say they often felt an acute sense of loss, of missing out on camping trips, sporting events, and simple lessons like learning how to tie a necktie and talk to girls. In a new book, best-selling author Donald Miller describes his life as a fatherless boy and young man and the mentors who helped him find his way. His new book is titled Father Fiction, Chapters for a Fatherless Generation. Donald Miller joins me in the studio to talk about his experiences and what motivated him to begin a mentoring program to help other fatherless boys. And, of course, we invite you to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, Donald.
Good morning.
It's good to have you here.
It's very good to be here.
What was it like for you growing up without a father?
Well, you know, I probably didn't realize emotionally that I'd grown up without a dad until I was in my mid to late 20s. I grew up in Texas. A friend of mine and I, when I was 20 or 21, jumped in a Volkswagen camping van. We were trying to get to Alaska just for fun. Ran out of money in Oregon. Sold the van, lived in the woods for a while, and then just fell in love with the mountains and ended up trying to go to college and all that in Oregon. And I rented a room from a family, a man and his wife and their kids. And that's the first time I ever saw a dad in a home. So it was really confusing to me. I mean, it was, you know, emotionally it was kind of like, you know, here's this guy walking around in his underwear, and the washing machine is already fixed, so I don't know why he's still around, right? You know, so it was just it was a foreign concept. And that's when I realized, oh, my word, you didn't have a dad. This is actually normal, and the way you grew up was not normal. Because I didn't have it wasn't a terribly sad childhood, but I just suddenly realized a lot was missing.
Tell me about that childhood.
Well, my mom is a wonderful, she's an amazing woman. An eternal optimist, a hero. I have a very heroic picture of single moms out there. She worked extremely hard. She worked very long hours in order just to pay our, you know, rent and our mortgage when I was a kid. And so a lot of kids, you know, I'm probably in the same situation. A lot of kids growing up without dads, you're essentially raising yourself. And, you know, you talked about learning to tie a tie. I learned to tie a tie in a big and tall store when I was 12 years old. So I was already, I've lost 150 pounds in the last 5 years.
Really?
And I think even some of that was tied to growing up without a dad. I mean, there just wasn't a sense of discipline and structure and all these kind of things that I think are there when there's a healthy father in the home. And
was he there at the very beginning?
No, not really. I think he left when I was about 2 years old. So I have no memory of actually living in a home when my father was in the home. Now, he did visit a few times all before I hit junior high. So when I went into junior high, he disappeared completely, and we had no idea whether he was dead or alive until I searched for him in my mid-30s.
And I remember that very well in your book. But your father moved away then when you were about 12?
Yeah, I mean,
you never saw him again.
Never saw him again. And even then, from 2 to 12, I probably saw him 3 times for a number of hours. So just not a factor.
What was your mother's relationship with him like when he came to visit?
I vaguely remember a couple conversations. It was interesting because my mom never talked about my dad, and I don't know if that's true for a lot of people listening, but we never brought him up. And I was in my 30s before I actually had any kind of meaningful conversation with my mother about my father. He was just not a subject that we brought up. In fact, I probably would have brought him up, but I just felt like there was some tension there that we don't talk about this. And, you know, as a kid, you just don't talk about things when it creates tension.
What about your classmates in school? Did they have dads?
Well, I had a neighbor across the street who had a father, and he would take us fishing, and he would mow the lawn with a weed eater in one hand and a beer in the other. And so I guess I assume that's what a dad was. My neighbor's father and Bill Cosby were the two early pictures of what a father could be. And I assumed that African-American culture had perfect families when I was growing up because they had a dad that was a doctor and all this kind of stuff. And I remember thinking, man, if I were only an African-American, I would have this great family, right? And, you know, so that's it. Just the stuff you see on television, and it wouldn't hit me for a long time what was missing in my life.
Read for us that little portion of the book that we picked out.
Yeah, this is from a chapter in the book in which I meet John McMurray, who would become, in my older life, I had many mentors when I was young. In my older life, he would become this kind of guy who actually taught me, my introduction to the idea that there was a father, this family that I was talking about. I thought the confusion I felt growing up without a father was just part of life, and there seemed to be benefits. Without the authoritarian structure of two parents, I could get away with a great deal more, and I disliked authority figures because they represented boundaries. The worst authority figures were older men. For reasons I didn't understand when I was younger, I resented them. I felt as though they wanted me to submit to their authority because they wanted to feel powerful. But I also wanted their respect and approval. And if I sensed disapproval, I belittled them in my mind. I was a split person. Half of me wanted to be mentored through life, the side, I suppose, that wanted a father, and the other half would rather not answer to anybody. I started realizing this several years ago when I moved in with a family, the family of a man who taught a college class at this church I was attending. I met John McMurray at a strange time in my life. I had left my home in Houston and was traveling around the country when I ran out of money in Oregon. I got an apartment in the suburbs of Portland where housing was cheap, and I started going to a church in a town called Boring, Oregon. The town lived up to its name. It had one stoplight, a convenience store, and a burger place. It was very beautiful, mind you, with views of Mount Hood and Mount St. Helens, river valleys and all, but once you were over that stuff, there wasn't much going on. The church I started attending was in the middle of a shrub farm, landscape shrubs and flowers and Christmas trees. Every November, the Christmas trees would be hauled down to people in Florida who paid $50 to hang lights on them, sing some songs, then watch them dry up and get pine tar all over their wicker furniture. This church was crowded with tree farmers, hunters, fishermen, that sort of thing, men's men.
See, that's what I want to ask you about. You talk about the discipline. You talk about the not wanting to be somehow told what to do. How much of a disciplinarian was your mother?
Mom was not a pushover. You know, that said, I didn't really go through much of a rebellious period when I was young. Not that she knew about. Now, when I was going into junior high, a friend of mine and I were breaking into houses. And there was a house across the street that I loved to break into because the guy had a gun collection. So when he was at work, I would break into his home through a window that he left open and bring a phone book and set it up against the wall in the living room. Then I would lay in his bedroom on the floor and shoot his guns at a phone book and then clean up the mess, you know, and air out the house before he could come home and, you know, lock up the house, close the window so that I could come back the next day. And I would try not to shoot too much ammo because I didn't want to. And that was my childhood. And I assumed, a lot of people don't understand this, I assumed that it's wrong if you get caught. There was not a real picture of right and wrong with me. Wrong was when you got disciplined. I mean, it's a very primitive consciousness that I think a lot of it wasn't there because there wasn't a dad around, but I was also really good at not getting into trouble. And so
not
mom,
getting caught.
Not
is
getting
what
caught.
You mean.
Not getting caught. And, you know, Diane, I just read the grand jury testimony from a case in Portland, Oregon, where I'm from. They don't usually release grand jury testimony, but they released 500 plus pages of a man who was shot by police, a young man recently. And I read that testimony, chilling details of him walking out of the house with his hands behind his head, walking backwards, mouthing off to the police, really nothing to live for, asking them to shoot him, then running behind a car, then pretending to pull out of a gun so they would shoot him. And as I read that, I thought, if there was only a man in his life who would be ashamed of him for what he's doing, if there was only a man in his life who would have been proud of some success that he had had, if there was only a positive male influence, you can see the decisions that he made would not have been the same decisions. And so there's something that happens when we have a dad. I tell the story in the book of a wildlife refuge in Africa where they took orphaned elephants and put them in this wildlife refuge. Everything was great until the elephants hit about 21. The older male elephants began to go through must cycle, which is normal. It usually lasts a week, then it stops. With these elephants, it didn't stop. It lasted a week, then 2 weeks, then 3 weeks. They began to get violent. They fought against each other. They isolated themselves. And then they began to kill rhinos at the watering hole, which is not normal elephant behavior. Nobody could figure it out. Somebody said, you know what? This is just not natural. If we bring in older male elephants, maybe something will happen. They shipped in, I think, two older male elephants. And immediately, after almost a year, the must cycles ended with the presence of an older male elephant. That tells us something, right? I mean, there's something about biochemically we are designed to be with a mom and a dad. And yes, there are success stories of just moms, success stories of just dads, but I think there's something else that we're missing here.
Donald Miller, pardon me, he's the author of Blue Like Jazz. His new book is called Father Fiction. More about those elephants and dads when we come back.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, 1 year after the fatal Red Line crash, we hear from Metro's official riders' representatives. Plus, too many specialists, not enough basic care. A new report says American medicine is failing to serve all of us. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
Visit WAMU.org to learn how you make everything on WAMU 88.5 possible, from your favorite shows to special events in the community. Member support is the backbone of our operation, so please become a new member or renew your support conveniently online at WAMU.org, and thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Sunny skies today, a high in the low 90s. 87 degrees right now in Northwest Washington. It's 10:20.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And if you've just joined us, Donald Miller is with me. His new book is titled Father Fiction, Chapters for a Fatherless Generation. Here's the first email from Kevin, who says, I've always had a problem with the assumption that boys need some kind of male influence. My brother and I were raised by a single mother without a father, nor were there any male mentors like priests or uncles. Neither my brother nor I have ever had any issues with that. We came out just fine. We've been in long-term relationships. I've been married for 36 years, my brother for 30. We've raised successfully sons and daughters. I wonder how much of this is just projection of a few fatherless boys of their feelings on a group.
I think it's a terrific question, and congratulations to Kevin. I'm sure there were a lot of great influence in his life, too. I think the issue is not that if you grew up without a dad, you're going to mess up. That's not the issue. The statistics, though, are much higher for you to mess up if you grew up without a dad. So 85% of men in prison grew up in fatherless homes.
85%.
I was just in a prison this year in Houston, Texas. I asked people to raise their hand if they grew up without a dad. Almost the entire room raised their hand, about 150 prisoners in the room. So 85% grew up without dads. Most of the people in prison are men. Some as high as 90% of people in prison are men. So boys are affected if they grew up without dads. Now, that said, I sat down to write this book, Father Fiction, thinking I've made it. I mean, I was like Kevin. I was like, I'm a New York Times bestselling author. I'm going to teach people how to make it. Started processing the issues and doing some research and realized I had a lot of issues because of this. So the book ended up being a piece of therapy for me. But I think Kevin's story is true. It's most kids grow up without dads actually do okay. But the statistics are a little higher for guys who get into trouble if they grew up without fathers.
You contrast your own upbringing with that of Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Right.
Talk about that.
I read this book, actually when I was young, I read this book where Eisenhower's mother actually said that she believed that every child should grow up in the understanding that if they didn't exist, their family could not function. So if you imagine a guy who grew up, obviously, to become president, interacted with the world in such a way that he presupposed the world needed him. That hit me very hard when I read it because I presupposed that I was a burden on the world. I presupposed that the world had to work overtime in order to pay bills. I presupposed that I was making the world tired when it came home at night. I presupposed that if I didn't exist, the world would be a better place. So it was a learning curve to understand that I could have a positive message for the world and actually contribute something to society. I had to learn that.
So is the basis of your message that boys should not be in a home without a father?
I don't like saying that because it's a pipe dream. It's not realistic. I'm also not willing to say that no father is worse than a bad father. I think it's a complicated world that we live in. I will say this. I wish that every young man had a positive male role model, and I wish that every young man had a great dad. I'll say that. I think once I leave that sort of a boundary, it gets complicated, and there are all sorts of contradictions, and I'm not comfortable making stands on anything other than I sure wish every kid had a great positive male role model and a great dad.
May I ask how old you are?
I'm 38.
Do you intend to have a family?
I would love to have a family, yeah. So hopefully that is in the cards in the future.
And you would be there.
I would quit my job, yeah. I would hopefully practice what I preach.
But tell me how you went about finding out that you needed mentors in your life.
Well, when I was breaking into houses, when I told you, I have...
So it was more than one house you were breaking into.
Well, no, I mean, it was probably... I remember two. I wasn't a common criminal. But you know, I was breaking into houses.
You bet.
And a guy... at the local church, actually, this is how I got introduced to sort of the church world. Interacted with me. He was in the neighborhood. The church was a few blocks away. Invited me to a book study. So we studied this piece of literature in the morning before school. I would read bits of it and kind of try to sound smart. And he gave me this guest column in a youth group newsletter that I think he printed on a Xerox machine for 25 people. He gave me like one column, and I wrote a review of the talent show at school. And somebody stopped me in the hall, or actually many people stopped me in the hall to say, hey, you know, you're a good writer. You're a pretty good writer. I sort of tell the comical story in Father Fiction because it was a horrible piece of literature. I'm so thankful that they lied to me. And that was the first time anybody had ever affirmed me for anything. And when people say, Don, why are you a writer today? I say, because I wrote a guest column in a youth group newsletter and somebody stopped me in the hall. That's the absolute reason. And at that time, I stopped breaking into houses.
You tell him that you had been breaking into houses?
No. I didn't know breaking into houses was wrong because I hadn't gotten caught.
Did anybody ever find out you were breaking into houses?
I never realized it was wrong until I put it in a book. And I thought, you know, that was crazy back then. So, I was smart. I didn't tell anybody. I probably owe somebody some ammunition So maybe
for
they'll
sure.
call.
For sure.
And a phone book.
All right. Tell me about the weight gain and when that began.
Oh, when I was a kid. You know, Mom was gone all the time, so we'd come home from school, and it was open season on what you were going to eat for dinner, you know, and that's a whole complicated issue that I'll never write a book about because I'm convinced I can't help any. I think it's Tom Arnold's book title, How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years and Kept It Off. You know, so I think I would write that book, How I Lost the Slowest Possible Way You Can Lose Weight. But I think it was part of growing up without the discipline of a dad. I mean, there's so many people who want to lose weight, and it's such a complicated issue to me it doesn't tie in. But it was a part of not having a sort of disciplined upbringing, not having somebody there to teach me the ropes on a bunch of issues.
Did your mother provide a positive presence?
Absolutely. My mother was an amazing presence, but she was also stressed. I mean, raising kids is a two-person job. Raising kids is a 10-person job, right? Narrowed down to two, and then when one of them is gone, it gets even harder. And when you don't have the emotional support that you need from a soulmate or a partner, I think it gets more difficult.
Here's an email from a teacher struggling in the D.C. public school system who says the effects of fatherlessness are seen in low student achievement. How do you see the relationship between education and mentoring? How can the mentoring project work with public education?
Those are two great questions. And Malcolm Gladwell references a study in his new book, Outliers, that I thought was fascinating. Kids growing up in single-parent homes that don't have these positive adult influences are actually doing just as well as kids who grow up in great homes. Where they fall behind, Gladwell referenced a study, is in the summer months. So the kids with parents are actually continuing to learn during the summer, and the kids without parents fall behind for 3 months in the summer and come to school having fallen behind. So we actually see there's a dramatic influence in education when there aren't parents in the home who are taking an active role in their kids' lives. And the mentoring project back home, you can learn more if I can say it, thementoringproject.org, about what we're doing in Portland. We will go national, hopefully this in early next year. The mentoring project partners with schools. We have many programs. One of our programs partners with local schools and provides mentors for kids that the school is saying, hey, can you provide a positive male role model for this kid? So the city of Portland has actually informally asked us to provide 500 more mentors in the city itself because the influence is so great.
And what do these mentors do?
Well, the emphasis is pretty simple. It's on friendship. So quality time spent with a kid. Now, we have programs that partner with the schools and after-school programs. So you actually show up at the school. You do a project after school hours with a group of other mentors. You know, we have figured out pretty quickly that we have an organization that reaches out to mentors. So if you can create a community, an adventure, some excitement for the mentor, they actually stick around and mentor the kids. So we have a model that encourages going to baseball games with other mentors, playing pickup basketball, playing frisbee in the park with other mentors. And the kids are trickled down from that community are these kids whose lives are changed.
You know, you have a chapter in the book called Self-Pity, How to Annoy People and Be Downwardly Mobile. Mm-hmm. So clearly, you had a fair amount of self-pity.
Yeah, I was enslaved by self-pity for many years.
What did that mean?
The Father Fiction is a book for people who grew up without fathers that talks about what we should have learned. And so, you know, adults get a lot out of this book because it's, here's how to interact with women. Here's what your dad would have taught you about that. Here's how to interact with men, what your dad might have taught you about that. And part of this is the idea of not feeling sorry for yourself. Probably one of the biggest paradigm shifts I've ever had is I realized that self-pity was something that I was addicted to because it was an excuse not to try.
How did it manifest itself?
Manifested itself and I can't exercise. I'm just not wired that way. I don't have a good work ethic. I'm just not wired that way. And even when I discovered that I grew up without a dad, that became an excuse for a little while. I read this book called Country of My Skull, and it referenced Bishop Tutu's work in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And they asked Bishop Tutu, who do you want on the Reconciliation Commission? Because they were going to go through these apartheid cases and bring some people to justice. And completely unrelated, I was reading it in my spare time, but I happened to be working on this book at that time. And Tutu said, I want victims. I want victims on the TRC. I want victims who have been, whose lives have been destroyed by the atrocities of apartheid. But this is what changed my life. Tutu said this: they have to be victims who have forgiven their oppressors. They cannot have self-pity. They must be, and these are his words, wounded healers. And I took Tutu's words as an invitation to dignity, integrity, to take the wounds of my life and give back. So self-pity was, no, I want to hold on to the wounds for some sort of commodity. But when I realized that in my faith that God could take my wound and change the world with it, now people say, Don, it must have been so painful to grow up without a dad. Diane, I can't even process the pain of growing up without a dad because my life has been so incredibly blessed. It's like, it must have been so painful to win the lottery. I mean, the stuff that has happened in my life because of this wound, the incredible blessings that have happened in my life because of this wound, I would never exchange for some sort of happy childhood.
So church and God became a great source of comfort.
An amazing source of comfort to me. And yeah, I mean, in my faith tradition, which is a Christian tradition, God actually refers to himself as Father. And this, of course, presents all sorts of complications for listeners as they read this through their own lens. But God became like a father to me in the sense that I trusted that he was going to guide me to comfort, to safety, to security, to strength.
Donald Miller, his book is titled Father Fiction, Chapters for a Fatherless Generation. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of callers. I want to open the phones first to Wichita, Kansas. Good morning, Andrew. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane.
Morning,
and thank
sir.
You to Diane and to Mr. Rehm for tackling Mr. Miller for tackling this topic so close to Father's Day. I am a child of divorced parents who had a better situation than your author. I now find myself a divorced parent, and I wonder if you have a few words of advice for a parent with custody who also has to cope with visitation and relationships with the parent without custody who might be disadvantaged.
Yeah. Well, I should qualify this, Andrew, by saying, you know, my book is for adult guys growing up without dads, and I'm not a parenting expert, but I do know that just your time, your involvement, your interest, your unconditional love of your kids statistically keeps a lot of kids out of trouble. And so that's the real gist of what kids need. And you can provide that in your situation for sure. When I met my dad, he actually said that the reason that he left was because he felt like he was not wanted by my mom, that there was a lot of tension there, and he just bailed out of the tension, you know, conflict avoidance. And I felt like, well, wasn't I worth the tension, you know? And so I think maybe in Andrew's case and a lot of other people's case, to just that your kids would know, hey, you're worth the tension is an enormous communication to them.
You know, your mom even tried to fill the role of both mother and father. You talk about a situation in your Boy Scout troop. Tell that story.
Yeah, my mom would recruit men to be to be positive male role models to me. So the first chapter of the book is just basically a stand-up comedy routine about these guys. And I used to love doing book readings with that chapter because I felt like a stand-up comic. But, you know, it's just guys. One guy, he flew airplanes, remote-control airplanes. He was this Vietnam vet, and he crashed. He would never let me fly the plane. And finally, he let me fly the plane. Within 8 seconds, I flew it into a tree, and he ran across the field shouting, "We've got men down. We've got men on the ground." and he wouldn't spend any time with me after I crashed his plane, because obviously I was obviously a communist. But he, so, you know, and then on and on and on. And there was oh, God bless him. He's such a great guy. There was my landlord's son. I'd met him once. He'd changed the light bulbs on the front and back porch. Took me to the father and son camp out as a recruitment for my mom, who was a pot smoking hippie driving a VW bug. And at the time when we were sitting around the campfire telling father son stories, your favorite memories with your son, he could only tell the story of the drive on the way there, and he referred to me as Doug. My name is Don. And so I had to correct him. My name is actually Don. Sure thing, Doug. So that was...
But she really was trying to help.
Mom was great. And, you know, without her, I probably wouldn't have met all the guys who were amazing, you know, and who did.
Did she date anyone?
Mom didn't date. She never dated. That I know of. She may have been hiding it from me, but she never dated, never saw him. I think she was, you know, she was pretty hurt. She was pretty wrecked.
Donald Miller, his book titled Father Fiction, Chapters for a Fatherless Generation. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email as well.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU 88.5 is proud to be a media sponsor for the 8th Annual AFI Discovery Channel Silver Docs Documentary Festival. This international celebration of the documentary starts tomorrow and runs through June 27th at the AFI Silver Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland. More information is at WAMU.org under calendar.
This week on Interfaith Voices, we meet Christopher Hitchens, the person. He's one of the world's best-known new atheists. But how did he get to that place? I'm Maureen Fiedler. Join me Sunday afternoon for the personal and sometimes surprising story of Christopher Hitchens. That's Interfaith Voices.
Today at 3 on WAMU 88.5.
Our weather forecast: sunny today, a high in the low 90s. Mostly clear skies tonight, a low in the low 70s. Tomorrow, sunshine with a high around 90. Partly sunny skies Tuesday, a high around 92. Partly sunny Wednesday, a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Hot again with a high in the mid-90s, and partly sunny on Thursday with high in the low 90s. Right now, it's 87 degrees in Northwest Washington. It's 10:39.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And as we talk about the book Father Fiction by Donald Miller, we'll go back to taking your calls in just a moment. But I do want to ask you about your sister and how she fared during this whole process.
My sister is a year and a half older than I am. She's doing wonderful. She's a florist in Houston, Texas. She's married with four kids. She's an optimist. She's done great. She fared in high school on. She had a little more trouble than I did. She got pregnant, had a child out of wedlock, and had a marriage that did not work out. And then found this guy, Fred, who's a hero to all of us, a wonderful, wonderful man. And they're now married and raising their family together. He had a child coming into the relationship. So she's doing extremely well now, but definitely struggled through those
affected,
formative years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And your mother is there in Houston.
My mother is in Houston. She's doing incredibly well. I left when I was 21, so that left her with an empty home. So my mother, who struggled as a secretary at an oil company for 25 years, I left, and she went back to college, got her bachelor's degree, then got her master's degree, then retired, and then Enron collapsed, and she lost all her retirement. So thankful for this book. Money from Father Fiction goes to my mom and to some other places, and you know, we've paid off her house, and she's
wonderful.
Doing great now. And she actually works. kind of for fun, at an interior design firm in Houston, runs their books.
Tell me why you titled this Father Fiction.
Well, it just sort of was a piece of prose that presented the idea that a father in my life was a fictional idea. So it's a literary look at the idea of a non-existent father.
Here's an email that says, it seems to me the author is looking for someone to blame, and not having anyone to blame has decided his bad choices and behavior are due to a lack of a role model. As a product of divorce, I have never broken into a person's house, stolen anything, or for that matter, intentionally lied. The other day, I helped an old man change a flat tire. No one ever told me I had to. I made the decision as a person to do right from a young age.
I think it's a terrific email. I would contend with the idea that I'm blaming my early issues on my dad, but because certainly I don't. That's of no help to anybody to blame somebody else for your issues. You have to take responsibility for your life. So essentially, I agree with that, but me too. And if I wouldn't have grown up without a dad, we wouldn't be recruiting a million mentors to shut down 15% of American prisons. So because I grew up with a dad, great things happen.
How are you recruiting?
Well, there are 360,000 churches in America, all sorts of denominations, all sorts of faith systems. Each of them has the infrastructure. They have the men. Many of them have a theological mandate to turn their hearts toward orphans. And so we are working with churches to basically start mentoring programs because there are fatherless kids in the hallways of their own churches that often get ignored. So we are working with churches, and we see that as the fastest way to recruit as many mentors as we can.
So tell us about this fatherhood task force.
Yeah, the president asked me on to the task force on fatherhood and healthy families, and we spent a year going around the country listening to different communities on different issues as it relates to fatherhood, healthy fatherhood. So we had a forum on education. We had a forum on criminals coming out of the prison and reentering society. And we took all this information and all the statistics, and we boiled it down into a report that the president can reference on the issue of fatherhood, healthy families, mentoring, fatherlessness. And we just turned that report in a couple months ago. And Monday at the White House, the president will announce what he will be doing on this issue. And we kind of know a little bit about that, and it's very, very exciting. The president has basically taken our suggestions and just gone way further than we've even suggested. It's an issue that he really cares about because he grew up without a dad and had positive male role models who were influential in his life and obviously succeeded. He's not a guy who has very much self-pity, obviously. A strong guy, so probably one of the greatest things that's happened to fatherhood. There is a piece of legislation called the Fatherhood, Marriage, and Family Innovation Fund that the president has just asked Congress to sign and fund. That will hopefully there'll be a vote on that this summer. That will aim $500 million toward mentoring programs, toward programs that encourage fathers to be responsible and to be there for their kids. And in my opinion, that's $500 million that will see an amazing return on investment.
All right, to Valerie in Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Wonderful topic, first of all. I was going to comment on pretty much my lifestyle being sounding basic similar to yours, although you are male, I'm female. But now I've kind of turned towards my grandson. My daughter, our oldest daughter, she is married. Her and her husband are going through the process of getting a divorce, and they have a now 5-year-old son. And he stepped out of his life when I think my grandson was maybe 8 months old. And his father stepped out of his life when he was maybe 8 or 9. Well, he always made the comment, I'll be bringing in the cheese because I'm going to take care of my own. Well, when it came time for that, he left. And he wound up getting another young lady pregnant. She has a little boy. Now he's out of his life. Well, I thank God, and I'm glad to hear that you are a Christian, because I am also. my father. I thank him for my husband, his grandfather, and I, our son, who steps in and pretty much not takes on a fatherly role, but they're good male figures in his life. Mm-hmm. Nobody can ever take the place of a father, because I didn't know mine till I was, well off, I think maybe 20, 21, 22 mm-hmm. years old. Mm-hmm. And he died a couple years ago, and I still really didn't get to know him. But I am glad that my husband and my son are there to kind of pick up that role where his father won't come into the picture and do so. But I am hoping later in life that he would have that kind of relationship, that he would be able to go back to his father and not necessarily say, well, why did you leave me?
Exactly.
Well, I'm grateful that you have the situation that you do, that he has a grandfather in his life who's there. But not only that, but he has you and he has his mom. That's something that we haven't talked about, is the sort of heroic, the real hero in all this are the women. We don't have a femininity crisis in America. We don't have a motherhood crisis in America. And people get frustrated with me because I always talk about the need for men, and they think I'm saying that we don't need women. Well, we don't have any statistics on the motherhood crisis in America or the motherlessness crisis in America, because they're staying with their kids. So, you know, that's great. What we do have is a masculinity crisis. And so what we're seeing, the statistics are tied to that because the moms are sticking around.
Tell me what it was like when you did meet your father.
One of the most frightening days in my life. I mean, after 30 years, well, first of all, I had a friend who worked in the district attorney's office, and I gave them all the information I had on my father. They found somebody with his name who lived within 20 miles of the house I grew up in, who had died about 9 years before. And I grieved the loss of my dad for a few weeks, and I didn't expect to grieve because I thought maybe he had passed, you know. And I grieved the loss of him. Then my mom called and said, "I've actually found him, and I talked to him." And I said, "Mom, this can't be true. The district attorney, blah blah blah." And she said, "Well, you're wrong. I talked to him on the phone." And probably another 6 weeks passed after getting his information that I actually called. I was in Chicago. He lived in Indiana. I knew that I was going to be in Chicago. I knew that I was going to be close to him. And I finally just said, I got to do this. So I sent out a text message to all my friends saying, I am going to go see my father for the first time in about 30 years tomorrow. Will you just text me tomorrow night or call me and ask me how it went? That's the only way I would actually follow through on it. Drove across Indiana. My dad was a basketball coach when I was a kid, so I have memories of seeing him in his element. I assumed that he left our home at 2 years old because I was already showing that I wasn't going to be a very good basketball player. So I'm literally driving across. This is how absurd all this is, right? Driving across Indiana going, if you were only athletic, your father wouldn't have left. And now he's going to see, he's going to discover you're not athletic or whatever. He's going to challenge you to game a horse in the driveway or something. And I was scared to death. I mean, I had to pull the car over, at least once, because I was just
shaking.
I couldn't figure out what I was scared about. How can you be scared or worried about the opinion of a guy you've never actually met or who didn't interact with you? So there's something there, right, that we've got to explore. And pulled up, knocked on the door, and he opened the door. He looked like I'd remembered him. Big man, 6'3", 6'4", barrel-chested, gave me a big hug. We talked. He had a beer in his hand and Fox News on and sat and watched Fox News and talked to me. I think I talked for 5 minutes and he talked for 2 hours. Told the story of what it was like when I was a kid and what he was going through. A really healing moment for me. My dad became a human when I sat and talked to him. And I realized that he was, first of all, that he was good, that he really wanted the best for me, that he was confused, that he didn't really understand how much his leaving had affected my life. And toward the end of that 2 hours, he looked at me and he said, "Will you forgive me for abandoning you and your sister?" And I had heard my pastor, his name is Rick McKinley, at Imago Dei Community in Portland. Rick McKinley, not much before this, gave a sermon on forgiveness. And he said, forgiveness is when you decide to carry the burden somebody has given you and not hold them accountable, or not hold them responsible. I don't want to say accountable because you have to hold them accountable. Not hold them responsible. That's forgiveness. So forgiveness doesn't make the burden go away. And that was huge for me because I realized I can still live with this burden, but not hold this guy responsible. I can let it go. I told him I forgave him, and I have never had a bitter feeling toward him since. Never. I mean, it's just done.
Have you kept in contact?
A little bit. My dad doesn't use the computer, doesn't use email. And so that's been actually a little hard because there's not a natural relationship or a rapport there that has to be built back up. So I would say I've been extremely slow in keeping up a relationship
with my dad. Has he remarried?
He's been remarried for 20 years.
And children?
Has a son, yeah.
You meet him?
I didn't meet his wife or his son. I just talked to my dad. They weren't there at the time.
You didn't want to?
Well, I did. You know, it was all too much. You know, we actually never talked until I showed up at the house. I left a voicemail. He left a voicemail. First time we actually talked was at the house. His wife didn't happen to be there. His son didn't happen to be there. And there's another son, half Cuban, in Florida. So I'm always wondering if I walk through Florida, if I see somebody who looks like me who's half Cuban, I'm going to stop him.
Donald Miller, his book is titled Father Fiction. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning. I just am so floored, Mr. Miller, because you are describing my son. The progression of your life, the pain and the difficulty. My son is 23 years old. I think you described yourself as enslaved by self-pity. I think this is my son. He stays at home at the house. He hasn't been able to hold a job. And his circumstances are a little different. He's the product of a divorce 13 years ago. His father, I think, was not available to him because he worked, you know, 12 hours a day. When he came home at night, he just was too tired. You know, he's a very successful businessman. But my son is screaming for a relationship with his father, but he's so angry with his father. He's, you know, he's gotten in trouble with the law. And his father's very disappointed in him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's too late for them. And if I want to talk to my son in a powerful way, and I want to be empowered by your book and by you this morning. I would love for my son and his father to just go on a vacation together.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got the money for that. He's got the resources for that. They're both, I think, very afraid of that, of the pain, you know, of the pain of what that's going to bring up, the just the two of them together. What would you say to my son?
I would say if you're husband, if your former husband is up for that kind of
adventure.
Wait
a minute, that's what I want to know. Barbara, is your husband?
Former husband.
Okay. Former husband.
Yeah, if he's up for that kind of adventure, that's going to change things. If they can get on a bike and ride it across the state together, you know, or climb a mountain or something, that confrontation and that healing has to take place. I would say at 35, when I met my father, unlike no other experience, I walked in as a boy and walked out as a man. Now, I didn't know that at the time, but looking back, all of that reconciliation and closure, that this older male authority was no longer hanging over me, rejecting me in my past. He was just a human being who I had forgiven, and I had the confidence to move forward. So those things all have to be dealt with.
What can Barbara say to her son to motivate him to make the effort to reach out to his father?
There's two things. One, I think the biggest paradigm shift that Barbara, your son, can do is cut the self-pity. I mean, that has to stop, and he has to realize that that's only going to hurt himself. So anything that you can do to help him do that, there's a chapter in my book about that. And then with the husband, to sit down and say, will you please pursue your son? I mean, in an aggressive, turn the other cheek, not going to stop until we reconcile and have closure. I think it's the dad's job there to initiate that.
You think it's the dad's job?
Yeah, I mean, how can you expect a kid to do it, right? I mean, it's the dad's job to lead, to guide, to initiate in that relationship.
You know, somebody has written us to say, it seems we never failed to celebrate Mother's Day, and Father's Day often passes with very little fanfare, except maybe a commercial advertising a sale at the hardware store. This person says, this show reminds us that fathers do matter. which is not a slight against single mothers, contrary to some people's reaction.
I'm so thankful that he said that, not a slight to single mothers, because my mom is a hero. But fathers have so much power that they don't realize it.
Donald Miller. His book is titled Father Fiction, Chapters for a Fatherless Generation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for your message.
Thanks, Diane.
And thanks all for listening. Happy Father's Day. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Ascendio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
The U.S. Surgeon General says obesity in America has more than tripled among 6 to 19-year-olds since 1980.
A lack of affordable fresh produce is one reason why obesity rates are rising. Community gardens and farms are trying to help by providing fresh produce and teaching healthy eating habits.
The Washington Youth Garden at the U.S. National Arboretum teaches children and families how to garden and cook the food they grow.
Common Good City Farm is an urban farm and education center that grows healthy food for low-income residents in D.C.
Common Good City Farm programs provide hands-on training in food production, healthy eating, and environmental sustainability.
More information is at WAMU.org. Click on Community.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5. This afternoon on Bob Edwards Weekend, for his latest film, actor John C. Reilly stars in Cyrus, a dark comedy co-starring Marisa Tomei. He discusses that movie and his career on Bob Edwards Weekend this afternoon at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
I'm Michael Martinez. I've been a producer at the Coast.